That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Can you hear that outside? I think someone's cutting a tree, so apologies if that is annoying, but don't worry, we've got a fantastic episode with the wonderful actor Nicholas Pinnock this week. How have you been? It's Thursday, so we're hurtling towards the end of the week, and if you've been in the UK, what a glorious week weather-wise it's been. I mean, I'm not going to bang on about weather, it's not a weather podcast, but it's really, it's certainly lifted my spirits. So yeah, keep on that, please, weather. We have no control. In the UK, it's probably going to rain in a bit. But until it does, let us enjoy the sunshine. Have you been out to a pub yet? Yeah, I went last Friday. It was very nice. It was slightly weird. Lots of people around. But we kind of got out of Dodge after sort of an hour and a half or something before it all started to get a little bit messy. Other people. Nicholas Pinnock, you're going to know him from ITV's Marcella, you'll know him from Top Boy, all sorts of stuff. It's a really interesting episode this week. I mean, we've, as you'll hear in the episode, me and Nicholas and I have been in talks and discussions to get this pen down for, we worked out, 3 years. So a long time. And he does not disappoint. It does get slightly industry, I must admit. But what it is, it's still about Nicholas as a human and his ethics and his morals and what he stands for and what he won't stand for, and learning and the thirst for knowledge and mental health. Yeah, he's a stand-up bloke. I really, really enjoy talking to him, and I really hope you do too. So, this is the Two Shot Podcast with the wonderful Nicholas Pinnock. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end.
Honestly, Nicholas, I've never seen two grown men so excited that they can actually hear each other after the tech issues that we've had. It's lovely to see you, lovely to hear you.
And I've been waiting to do this for so long.
I know, the thing is,
it's been years. I
sound like a broken record on this podcast sometimes, because it's like, I always go, oh, we've been trying to make these dates work forever, and we really have.
Yeah.
You know, me and you have been actively trying for what does seem like years.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it's been about 3 years, I think, when we first contacted. We got in contact and started talking about the possibility of doing this.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And look, how are you, mate? Are you okay?
I'm really well, yeah. I'm the only word I can describe is fucking epic.
This is great news.
Yeah.
The birds are singing in the background, I hear.
They are. Oh, do I need to close my window?
No! Look, I love the Atmos. It makes me...
Oh, good.
It makes me feel that I'm back in a room with somebody.
Does that mean I could open them up even more?
Look, do that. Let's let it in. It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, it's lovely.
So, I was thinking, and I was doing some reading about you.
Yeah.
Do you remember being in Saudi Arabia, or were you too young?
I do remember. I was, I was, the first time I went out there, I was seven. And I never, and I came back when I was 12.
Was this for parents' work, obviously?
Yeah, my dad was an electrical engineer and my mother was a nurse.
What were your memories of being over there in Saudi Arabia? Because that's quite, it's a complete culture clash, surely.
Yeah, I mean, it was nothing but good memories, really. My father worked on worked for a German construction company. And there was nothing but Germans on the camp and a few, you know, I hate the term expats because it's sort of very elitist and it actually, we were immigrants. There was lots of immigrants from all over the world living there, but it was a majority German. So if you didn't have basic German, you kind of couldn't get around, really. I went to an international school there, so people from all over the world taught under an English system. It was brilliant. It was really good. And then when I was nine, we moved to a place called Yanbu, and went to an American international school.
Right.
And that was equally a lot of fun. It was 1984. We had boomboxes and cardboard to break dance on the streets in.
The best year, surely. The best years.
Oh, of course. Yeah, and it was amazing. It was really, really good. Great culture, great people. It was a lovely experience. I mean, it's really hard sometimes when you hear that. You know, Saudi Arabia is going through all these human rights issues and everything, and the whole world is looking at them. And you kind of go from my point of view, I can understand that, you know, we're in 2021, they're in 15 something. Mm-hmm. And as a civilization, they're not as advanced as we are. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to just let them go on and, you know, make the mistakes that we made. But it wasn't so long ago that women couldn't apply for a credit card without having their husband sign
for
them. Yeah,
of course.
You know, homosexuality was illegal up until the 1960s. We hung the last person in 67 or 69. I can't remember which year it was. But it was around that era. So actually, we're not... So when they talk about, you know, chopping people's hands off and stoning people, you think, well, we're not too far away from that. Can we not have some compassion? Remember that these... You know, we were in the Stone Ages at one point and actually kind of give them a helping hand and say, listen, we kind of went down that route and it didn't work so well. And, you know, maybe we can help you along and get there a bit quicker than we did, rather than pointing the finger and being so judgmental. So I'm kind of protective about it because, you know, it's a big part of my childhood. And the people I experienced nothing but humanity and warmth and kindness from Saudis.
But saying that, do you ever feel... Because I know sometimes... It's very rare, I think, certainly doing what we do. Because you're forced into first day of school quite quickly on these new jobs and you have to forge these relationships.
Yeah.
So you have to be warm, you have to be humane. And sometimes when that isn't returned, not that you should expect it, but certainly... As a decent human being, it should be there. And sometimes when it isn't there and it isn't reciprocated, I find that quite jolting. And it makes me think, oh, well, is everybody like this? And of course they're not in this business.
No, of course they're not. Of course they're not, which is a shame. You know, you would like to think that people in the arts have an understanding and, you know, have a certain knowing that that's the case with everybody. But, you know, we're all riddled with such deep insecurities, aren't we, that... Sometimes it's not easy to overlook that for everybody. But when you find the people, it makes all the difference.
Yeah, and also if you find those people or you are become one of those people or you learn to be one of those people that sticks their hand up and goes, yeah, actually, no, I'm not all right with that, or I am insecure about such and such and X, Y, and Z, that's going to be okay, isn't it? Yeah, of course, because you know what? So-and-so is exactly the same, and you know what? I have days like that when I'm exactly the same. Yeah. So you go, oh, for you, right, it's great. It's not just me. And there's the acceptance, which I think is so important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic that you said how happy the childhood was, certainly there, because you've already touched on moving to two different schools. And sometimes, you know, you want to get to school, you get your little tribe of friends, and then you stick with those for a few years. But then you're moving around, so sometimes that can affect a child. So did that affect your confidence as a child? Or, I mean, it didn't. Doesn't seem.
No,
so.
Not at all. Not in the slightest. No, and actually, without thinking about it, it was good training for what it is that we do.
Right. Start. Yeah.
Because we're constantly moving from school to school to school, and it's like people say to me, "Why are you nervous on your you know?" Because I constantly say, "Well, I get a new gig and I'm nervous." They go, "Why are you nervous? You've done this before." I said, I haven't done this role in this piece with these people before. So it's the first day at school.
Yeah.
So every single time it's like you have to make new friends and, you know, you hope that they like you and you hope you like them. And, you know, you hope that the classroom is, you know, really nice and you hope that the playtime is really good too, you know, and you find friends and you can, you know, you can
play. And you hope to be flexible because you want people to be flexible with you. So it's nice. It's a lot of give and a lot of return. But yeah, it's exactly right.
So it was good training. And I adapted very well because I had to, you know. And I think what I learned over there, especially when I went to Yanbu, the second place we ended up in, at the American International School, was it was years later in therapy I realized this. This couldn't change. The colour of my skin couldn't change. But you wanted to assimilate and be as much like the masses as possible because you want to fit in. So this changed. And I walked around with an American accent.
Really?
Yeah. Only when I got home, when I was through the threshold of my door, I was switched back to British because my parents were not allowing me to speak with an American accent. But the moment I stepped in out with my American friends, when I was with them, I was, you know, people thought I was, you know, an American because you had to assimilate. Now, kids from Nepal, kids from Sweden, kids from the Philippines, they all did exactly the same thing.
Did they now?
Because, because you code switch and assimilate because you want to fit in because there's a lot of things about your appearance you can't change, but how you sound, you can. So all the kids walked around with an American accent.
That is so interesting. So for you, you know, starting out as a young actor, you were starting to train very early on and wanting to fit in.
And I didn't even realise that was happening. But it was all by... You realise these things aren't coincidental. These are by design. Mm. Because by the age of 4, I knew exactly what I wanted to do for a living. Mm. And then, you know, at 7, I started dancing. And then when I came back from Saudi Arabia at 12, I went straight into stage school. And that's been my life for the past 36 years.
Where did the inspiration for the dance come in? Because seeing it, you know, a young boy dancing, it's not... I mean, we've all seen Billy Elliot. We know certain stories of that. But certainly for sort of from our... around our sort of age group, that would have been quite, certainly, and certainly for me, you know, there's a thing about, you know, being in the north, and certainly it was tough for me when, you know, I said, you know, well, I want to be an actor. So as much as we all wanted to fit in, I was, you know, 6'4", skinny, you know, called Craig. There was nobody else called Craig at my school. I said to someone the other day, I didn't want to be Craig. I wanted to be a John. I wanted to be a Daniel. I wanted to be a Mark. Yeah, I wanted to like football. I don't. I'm useless at it. Stick him in goal. That was where I was.
You stood out enough being really tall, let alone having a name like
exactly.
Craig.
Exactly. I mean, everything was against me. Plus, then I go, I want to be an actor. Because we all wanted to fit in. So, certainly... A boy dancing.
I blame my sister.
Okay.
My sister has been one of my biggest inspirations. So she started dancing at this local church hall, the Yvonne Pearl School of Dance. And, you know, went to pick her up one day with my mum, and I went in there and I saw all these girls dancing. And my sister was there and I went, oh my gosh, I want to do that. I want to join. So I ended up doing, that was my first experience. I ended up doing dance classes there, tap and ballet and modern and all sorts of things. Yeah. And then it was another confirmation for me, having decided at 4 that I wanted to be one of those people in that square thing in the corner of the room that made these people, my family, react like that. I wanted to be in there. And then seeing Elvis Presley and Cannonball and all sorts of variety people, I went, that's my life. that's my life. So then dancing was like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. And then to go to stage school at 12 and get my first job on the first day I landed and did an audition, I was like, yeah, this is heaven. So by the time I got to 14, I had deliberately decided to forego my GCSEs because I thought if I had something to fall back on, I'd probably fall back on it. I wouldn't make this work. I want to make this work. So if I don't give myself an out, I'm going to stay in.
So you're going to put all the eggs in that basket. So then there is no choice. You just have to graft and work.
Absolutely. And if it doesn't work, then I'm fine.
Look, I've always said, I say to younger actors, you know, this business is precarious enough. You have to work, and face that rejection because it's in the post, you know?
I was doing
something last year for some students in Manchester, and we were having a big old chat because they were putting on one of their third year shows on Zoom, and amazing for them. They were brilliant. I had to talk to them afterwards. I'm really sad that you have to do this because you shouldn't be having to do this after 3 years of training. You should be out there. And then I was talking to them about, you know, this in a way, this is your first part of rejection because you should have been doing this on stage in front of an audience, but you're not. You're doing it online and it's a little bit sad, but you've success, but that's done. And then the director afterwards was texting me and saying, you shouldn't have told them about rejection. That's not right. I said, whoa. I think it's vital that they're told about rejection. Because I was thinking, I wish there was somebody who was as honest as me, who spoke to me in my third year, in a very realistic sense. As honest as it is sometimes to hear, it's another bit of training that you can stick in your rucksack that you carry around all the time. It's there for you.
Because you can teach acting, you can teach dance, you can teach singing, you can teach all these things, but you need people to teach you the industry. And that's luckily what I got at stage school. Because when I was there, I was at a stage school called Corona Academy in Hammersmith, and we did like E! News World and, you know, Grange Hill and all sorts of stuff when I was a kid. But we had, all of our teachers were on the West End or on variety shows or in films or on TV programs because they had all been to the school previously or just gotten jobs teaching in their spare time. So we had all these major professionals teaching us not only the craft but the industry as well, and it was absolutely valuable.
That is so vital because as incredible as the teachers are, and I'm blanking in now, this is nothing specific at all, but teachers who tutor there day in, day out, week in, week out, term by term at drama school, amazing. They're giving groundings of training.
Oh, they are, absolutely,
no doubt. But I remember when guest directors and lecturers and tutors would come in who were current, who were working in the business today, would come in, and then they'd shine a light on something that wasn't touched upon because they were out there working or directing today. So I think there always needs to be a nice balance with that. Certainly,
now. The industry changes, and what was industry standard or norm 15 years ago has kind of shifted now.
Absolutely.
And so the constant, when you've got someone who's out there on the floor actually doing it, bringing that to the students, it's amazing.
When did because it sounds to me, and I know that, you know, dance and music was something that was a big part of the training at first. When did it switch that, not necessarily that you turned your back on it, but you wanted to be more focused and led by acting, I suppose, quote-unquote acting, putting it into that box?
So I think what happened was I went to, after stage school, I went to a performing arts, college, really, in King's Cross. And
how old were you now, Nicholas? Late teens?
I was 16 at this point. Right, okay. 16, yeah. I was like a couple of weeks 16, actually. I was the youngest entrant into the college at that time. And we did basically everything I was doing at school, but just without the academics. And we did it all day long, and it was absolute bliss. And I became quite good at everything. I was, you know, I was a triple threat. I could sing, dance, and act to professional standard. And I made a conscious decision that while I was young and fit and I could still do it and enjoy it, I was going to spend a lot of time dancing. But in the back of my mind, I always knew that acting was where I was going to end up. And so I joined a contemporary dance company straight after I left. And I didn't end up in the West End because I figured that I'd looked at people who had done it before me. Figured if I'd gotten into doing West End, I wouldn't be able to transition into acting so easily. So I avoided that. Just kept dancing. I got roped into, I did some modeling, and I was always coming back and doing, you know, an episode of something or a couple of episodes or something or a bit of theatre. I was always doing bits and pieces. And then when I turned 30, I just said, right, that's it. Not doing this anymore. And literally started saying no to anything else other than acting.
Which I think, and I've said this before, I'm sure I've said this on air before, that I think that is such a powerful thing to say, is to say no. It's a scary thing to do.
Oh, it's your biggest superpower.
It's exactly that, yeah. My friend, exactly that. To say no, and eventually there will come a change, because that's the only power that you have at that, that time, is to say no.
Yeah.
And we all know how scary it is, but it's scary for that window, that very small window. And then after it, there's a release, and then there's, you know, a sense of pride, a sense of power, and then we move on.
Absolutely. But it is, it's a performer's only thing that they control is what they don't do. You know, what you do is kind of here or there, because you audition. If you get a role, you may do it. But even saying no to auditions and going, that's not the type of work I want to do, but I need money. Do I do it or not? Is it going to help my career? No. Will not doing it help my career and leave the door open for something else? Yes. Okay, I'm going
to
say no.
You've got to roll the dice. You really have.
You have to.
But also, I think that's really important what you said there about even turning down an audition. Because I've always thought, if you can't see yourself doing it, right, why would you, one, waste your time, waste somebody else's time, then if they turn around and like you got offered it, and then you say no, they go, well, fucking hell, we've gone through all this. You've got everybody's hopes up. You could have just...
But it's part of the conditioning of the industry, though, isn't it? You know, you're conditioned to... Well, they've got a job, and they're offering it to you. Take it. Of course you do. Because it's such an unpredictable business, and you never know when you're going to work again, and you're fed this whole rhetoric all the time that you can't... it's very difficult to get to that point where you actually take ownership of your decisions. And I think actors need to... You know, really, really need to understand that what they don't do is, in often cases, more important than what they end up doing. Because one yes can ruin your career, and many no's can enhance it.
I think you're absolutely on the money there, definitely.
You know, but it's hard. I mean, people often say to me, "Oh, yeah, but you're in a position to say no." And I have to remind them, I was saying no when I was 30 grand in debt, working in a hotel, having two jobs as an acting and voice coach, having someone live in my spare room because I had a mortgage to pay, which I was 3 months in arrears in.
Right.
And I was paying the minimum on my credit cards. And I was still turning down work and saying no, because it was not the type of work that would have gotten me the work that I'm doing now, and we would not even be chatting on this podcast, put it that way.
I mean, we focus quite clearly on training at the moment, and you were touching on some stuff in your personal life there. So you weren't just floating around saying no and waiting. You were out there grafting other jobs. As you say, you were working in a hotel. And
oh, I had to. And I would do that tomorrow if I had to, because I made a conscious decision when I was young. I was a child. I was about maybe 13. And I had done this... do you remember Thames Television?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you remember the programmes that used to make for schools and television?
Yes.
Yeah. So I did a few of those. And I remember doing one and really, really, really loving it.
I thought you were going to say the opposite then.
No.
Craig, I hated it so much.
No, I absolutely loved it. And at that point, something kicked in and I realized that I will never use this industry to make money. Never. I will never use this industry to make money or make a living out of it. If that happens, amazing. But I'm not going to go, how much is it? And actually, I need the money. If I need money, I'm going to find that elsewhere. Because the moment you start using this industry because you need to pay bills, what you end up doing is start taking things you don't really want to do. You end up, therefore, the self-loathing grows and you start to hate your job and it becomes a job and your love for the industry dies completely and then your dreams are shattered.
Absolutely.
And I knew that I couldn't let that happen to me, so I would rather make money doing something I hated doing and then only leave this as a passion and something I really love doing and hope that eventually the day would come where I could have my passion, love what I'm doing and make a living out of it. And I'm so glad that I did, because I've gotten to that stage and life is fucking epic.
And it takes time.
Oh.
And I think it's such a good mindset to have, is if you need to make money, I'll find that and I'll work harder somewhere else. But to go into this, you know, walking this tightrope all the time in this business and thinking, yes, I'm in it to make a load of dough, it's the wrong, that's the wrong reasons. And also... go on.
It is the wrong reasons, but there are some people that do that, and all they want is either fame or they want money. And I don't judge it, because, you know, but I go, well, you know, the quality of your work's not great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't really understand the industry in the way that I want to understand mm-hmm. the industry. And all power to you. If your remit is to make money, fantastic. Keep doing the shit you're doing. And if your remit is to be famous, go ahead. It's not for me. It's not for me. You go and make all the money you like. All the money you like. Be famous, be rich, do what you want. I want to be satisfied. Yeah. I want to be happy. I want to be proud of the work that I deliver. And so, for me, fees are nothing. It's like, I never ask how much it is until I get the job. And then once I get the job, then you go and negotiate your heart out. But up until that point, I'm not interested.
No, because you're...
And it's funny.
Go on.
You know how in America they give you all the information. They go, this is what it is per episode. The first time it happened, I went, this will never happen again. Don't ever tell me how much it is, because I'm not interested. If I either like the job, I want to be a part of the story, and the role is something that scares the shit out of me that I feel I have to do, or I'm not doing it. No amount of money is going to make me do a show. And it's a really... I find that really... it gives me so much liberty and freedom from all the other bullshit that comes with, you know, that comes with our job. Because all I want to do is the work.
But also...
Everything else is irrelevant.
It puts everything aside, but it puts one thing into focus, the right thing into focus, and that's the role. That's the part. That's what speaks to you. It's not someone waving a checkbook with loads of noughts on the end of it.
That's right. Because our job is, you know, we have one job and one job only, and that is to, we have one job and one job only, and that is to tell the story. My job is not to be rich. My job is not to be famous. My job is to tell the story as an actor. And that's what I want to do. And that's what I want to do at all costs.
And as you say, walk away at the end of the day and be proud of hopefully what you're delivering.
Yeah.
So we touched briefly there on sort of your personal life, about what you were doing when you... Because at the moment, what I'm getting is there isn't much time for a personal life, because there's... if you're not doing what you love, you're doing something you don't particularly love, because there needs to be food on the table and there's mortgages to pay. And there's a lodger to wake up in the spare room. So how did that affect...
Luckily I don't have that anymore.
Well, no, I would have hoped not. But, you know, needs must. And we all know what it's like.
Absolutely.
If it happens again, that spare room's open and someone's going in it.
Tell me about it.
How was the business affecting you as a person? Because we all need downtime.
Mm.
So did that affect you? Did you find yourself that you were maybe sometimes too focused, or you were too, had the mindset of working too hard? Because what I'm getting from you is that you want the knowledge and you want to graft.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, back then I had, it was twofold really.
Hmm.
I was, 15 years ago I had a mental breakdown.
Okay.
And, you know, I was, I was in a situation where I was struggling. And things, you know, life got on top of me. It became too overwhelming. So I had a breakdown. Now, the only thing that saved me, my only safe space and comfort zone, was work. Whereas some people can't work.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing I could do. So when I wasn't getting the roles that I wanted, and I wasn't being fulfilled in the offers that were coming to me, it did become something that, you know, wore away at me. And so I, you know, there were times in the hotel when I was, you know, carrying someone's luggage up to the room, and, you know, earning £5.80 an hour and 8 hour shifts with a half hour break, sometimes doing double shifts because I needed the dough, that I just thought, when is this going to stop? When am I going to, you know, get back on stage, or when am I going to get back in front of the camera? Because I kind of need that to feed my mental health and give myself some space away from all of this. And so it was kind of stressing at the time, but I also knew that if I ended up just going, okay, I'm going to do anything just to soothe that beast, that it was going to end up being far worse for me. So I had to be even stronger in my power of, no, not doing that. No, not doing that.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to go out for that audition. Even knowing my situation, you know, so the mental health and the financial situation. But again, you know, the money they were offering me was never going to be, you know, was never going to be an option for me to take the job.
No.
And the job itself, for the things that I was being offered, were never going to be roles and stories that were going to soothe my soul and make me feel worthy and help me grow and learn, because they just weren't in that register. I wasn't frightened of the roles. And I wasn't hungry to be a part of the story, because anything I do now, so I'm going off to do a gig in Romania for 7 months, and I am shit scared.
Really?
Because the role frightens the hell out of me. But when it frightens the hell out of me, I know that's the one I have to do.
Is that always something that always has to be like in your contract to take a role? That it needs to be fresh and it needs to be scary for you as an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's where I know I'm going to grow. And I don't know what growth looks like. I don't know how it feels. I don't know what's at the other end.
No.
And so it's the fear of the not knowing. Can I do this role justice? Can I tell my part in this story in a worthy way? Can I deliver? I don't have that answer yet.
But in a way, it's the contrast. It's the beauty and the darkness of the business that is appealing.
Yeah.
And also
absolutely
the fact that gaining the knowledge never ends. Because whoa, we're at this school for a few months and then we'll graduate that. And then we move on to something else, and we're learning something else, and we'll graduate from that. It'd be very different.
That's
It'd be very, very different.
True.
Very different to the last school.
Yeah.
And yeah. Hopefully I'm going to get on with people, and hopefully I'm going to graduate in a way. But I don't know, and I'm terrified. Yeah. But that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
And I just want to jump back to.
Mm-hmm.
During the darker times for you, the tougher times, I don't, and I know me and you, we've spoken quite openly together about things like this before.
Yeah.
And I certainly think it's something that, you know, we should have a discussion about more and more. And I know that you're an ambassador for Mind, which we'll come on to later, who do fantastic work. And I've shouted them out a lot of times on here. It's very interesting that you had that clarity of thought, that you knew that work was the safe space for you.
Yeah.
But having said that, you weren't going to go back on your own sort of contract that you have for yourself and just take anything going, just as you say, to feed the bees. That wasn't going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It was a real minefield. Yeah. It was really hard. It was...
Was it a slow progression, Nicholas, or did this happen? Did you gain clarity that some things weren't right for you before the breakdown, or did it just manifest itself and blow up in your face, so to speak?
No, I'd been depressed since childhood. When I look back on the therapy that I had, it was very clear that I'd been depressed, you know, in childhood and during my teenage years and my early 20s. And I remember in my early 20s speaking to a friend of mine saying, I need to speak to something, something's not right. And then literally switching it off and never doing anything about it. Then I turn 30 and I can feel this, you know, energy building and I can't quite figure out what it is. And then by the time 33 came, it felt like I'd been just disconnected from the world and everything and everyone in it. And I couldn't function anymore. I literally could not function on a day-to-day level.
Did you find yourself shutting yourself away from the outside world, or did you begin to sort of reach out?
No, I shut myself away. But I had no choice but to, you know, I had no choice but to receive help, because I literally couldn't function. I couldn't eat, I couldn't stop eating, I couldn't cry, I couldn't stop crying, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't stop sleeping, I couldn't talk, I couldn't stop talking. I was lost, absolutely lost. So I had no choice but to go into therapy, or else it would have been, you know, the suicidal thoughts would have become an act.
Were those thoughts there? Were they there? Were they very real for you at the time?
Oh, absolutely. Right. And they still are, you know, but there is a difference between the thoughts and the act of suicide. Mm. And I've now, you know, back then the thoughts were so, so powerful. You know, I would stand at the edge of a balcony and I'd even put my leg over once and, you know, that was it. It was time to jump. That was going to happen. And then subsequently something stopped me every time. But I understand now that even when they do arise in dark moments, that, it's just a thought. Yeah, it's just a thought of it. Fine. And it can come and go and not have the power and the strength that it did, because I've done so much work to understand where they are and to understand me a lot more and to understand my mental health and to embrace it, actually, rather than fight against it the whole time. Because I think that is far more tiring than actually just going, okay, we're going to stay in bed today? Great. Come on then. Let's just stay in bed for another few hours if you don't feel like getting up. Because the weight of you is too much for me to fight with right now. Fine. I'm just going to stay in bed. And I did that a few Sundays ago. I literally didn't get out of bed until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then, you know, I said to it, should we go and get some food? Yeah, come on then. And, you know, it works with me now as opposed to against
me. Yeah, but also you're the one that's asking the questions and you're the one that's taking control, instead of it can take control of you. And because, as you said, you've done more work, so you've done more graphs, so you've gained more knowledge about this and within yourself. So therefore, you've now control over it.
Yeah.
But how can you control something that you have no knowledge over? Which is why, you know, to reach out and to seek help, you know, with professionals is fucking vital before it eats you up.
Well, the thing, we go to the gym because we want to get stronger bodies and stronger muscles and we want to be fitter. But we shun therapy, which is exactly the same thing for the mind.
Mm. Yeah.
Doesn't make sense to me. Doesn't make sense to me at all. And I think we, you know, we need to, as a society, as global societies, we need to rethink our focus on mental and physical health. and not see them as separate, first of all, and not see one as more important than the other. And right now, physical health is more important than mental health, because you can see when physical health is deteriorating or it's not very, you know, it doesn't function. If someone breaks a leg, you can see it. But I know I have to say sometimes now, you know, people ask me how I am. I say, I'm not feeling very well. You look all right. And I have to point to my head.
Yeah.
Because they just assume that, you know, well, you look great. You know, how can you not be well? You don't sound like you've got a cold. No, I've got fog up in here. And things are not right. I'm really not feeling well, so I can't come out and play today.
Yeah, sorry. I was explaining to my almost 10-year-old about it, because the school, when everything was, and I don't want to talk about what we've all been through that much on here, because there's a time and a place for that, but this is kind of in conjunction with what we were talking about. The school were talking about, you know, when we come back to school, everything's going to be a bit different, but we're here to talk. You know, sometimes if you feel a bit sad within in yourself, in your mind, that's okay. We can talk about it. So we were, I was having this discussion with him at home, and I was saying, and he was trying to, and he's, you know, he's almost 10. He's just constantly asking questions, and sometimes I just don't have the answers for him. But I was saying, I said, so, right, so when we break our arms or we break our legs and the doctors go and they put a cast on and we can go, oh, look, they can see that they can get an x-ray, they can see the bone is broken and they know what they need to do. I said, but sometimes if you sort of fracture or you break your mind, no one can really see that at first. So it takes a bit longer to delve into it. And the special people who can really talk to you and find out what's going on, but we just need to begin discussions about it. He went, okay, right. So he kind of got it a bit more when I use that sort of analogy. You know, I would not only say that to an almost 10-year-old, I would kind of use that for anybody. It's just, it seems to me to be
absolutely
so clear and concise about what it is.
And I think as actors, as performers, I think something very special happens with us. And I don't think most people, and I actually don't think most actors realise this, that our subconscious has no idea that we're acting. And so it releases exactly the same chemicals as if we're angry or if we're horny or if we're, you know, grieving, or if we are jealous, if we're happy. Our bodies release the same chemicals because the subconscious has no idea. So when we are dealing with the darker sides of the characters that we're playing, what happens is we leave at the end of the day. Our conscious mind knows that this is a job. Our subconscious, no idea. So we leave at the end of the day and we're carrying these chemicals that don't actually belong to us.
Yeah.
Because we are the vessel for these characters. We sometimes find it difficult separating what's ours and what's theirs. And that can cause so much confusion, which is like why I think, I truly believe that's why a lot of us end up in therapy, AA, NA, OA, all the other SLA, you know, all these things, because our behavior and our acting out is not necessarily born out of our own stuff, but the stuff that we're carrying from our characters that we haven't let go of yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is some, you know, specific therapy that we need. And I'm trying to desperately start a fund to and a campaign to make sure that we have, as well as physical first aiders on sets and in theatres, that we have mental health first aiders as well, because some of the things that our characters have to go through can be quite dark.
Oh, absolutely.
And can really knock on the door of some of our stuff that feels very similar and attach itself to that stuff that feels similar, therefore making us think that our stuff has come up again and we're never getting rid of it, and really it belongs to him or her.
Exactly. I mean, that is so interesting. I think it's vitally important what you're saying, because, of course, look, when we're on set and we're dealing with firearms, we've got an armourer to show us what to do. If we've got a complicated fight scene, we have a stunt coordinator who's a professional who will show us how to do things safely. If I'm playing, and I have done, you know, quite dark characters that would do truly awful, abysmal things that you read about in the papers and that you don't want to read about, because you want to shun that news away because it's too real. Sometimes my little boy, when he was much younger, he was mad into Bob the Builder. I'm going off on a tangent now. And I got Neil, I got Neil Morrissey to ring him up and leave him a happy birthday message as Bob the Builder. And yeah. And I played it to him, and the look in his face, he was terrified. He went, "Too real, too real." He couldn't handle it. He just couldn't handle it that it was too real that Bob was calling him. It freaks him out. And that's sometimes what I feel when I hear or I read something, in the newspaper or on the radio, and I just think to myself, "This is too real, man. This is too real. I don't need this darkness in my life." But that's the thing. There's nobody there to help me after that, or help you, or help anybody else after we've gone down the route of playing such a dark path, because where's the aftercare there? If a stunt goes wrong, that's okay. We've got paramedics on set. They can hopefully, if it's not too awful injury, they can patch it up and sort it out. But if you're going home at night, I mean, you go home at night anyway, whether you come off stage or you come off set, and there is a reason why you're not going straight to bed, because, as you said, you mentioned, we've got all these chemicals buzzing around, and that's why it takes time to come down off that ledge. But if you're still thinking about those thoughts or the subconsciouses, where's the aftercare there? So I think what you're saying is really, really interesting and vitally important moving forward.
You think about the amount of times you've done a play and how many actors end up in a pub every single night after a performance.
95%.
Exactly. Because you're trying to medicate and you're trying to get rid of those thoughts and feelings that you don't really understand. And it's exhausting. And I think, I think we need, there is specific care that we need as a community, as actors, and performers, but it's also stage managers, it's also directors, it's also writers that are in the room or on the floor experiencing these things with you, because it can trigger some of their own stuff too.
Absolutely, I think it's the whole team.
Yeah,
absolutely, because everybody's. Yeah. The great thing is, I think less and less now. And maybe it's just the fact that we're getting older and we see it more clearly. But there is no us and them anymore. There's no us and them. There's no sort of hierarchy.
No, there is.
From the execs, and I don't say down, I say across to, the runner who's just started. We're across, we're all on the same team. And it affects everybody, because everybody's trying to do their job the best they can.
Yeah. And I just hope that, we can make something work so that the theatres, the BBC, all the channels, all the studios can slowly start to really take this seriously and care for the people that, that are trying to deliver entertainment, essentially, for everybody. Because you think about it, every time you watch a piece of TV or film or you go to a theatre and you're laughing or crying or in shock with the actors, if it's moving you that much, if it's moving you to tears, let's say, what's the actor going through to actually make us feel that way? To the power of 10 to what
we think. You would think so, wouldn't you?
You can clearly see the after effects of the damage that it can often do.
And that's it's so important. But we've got to keep talking about this. Will you keep me in touch about how you get going about this? I know. That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, no, of course. I'll send you a proposal that I've been working on, and you can give me some notes.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I'll certainly support whatever you do, man. Was it a conscious decision to go to the States and certainly, take work over there?
So that's a whole other story. So I never wanted to go to the States.
I did think that.
I'd always said, I work quite well here. I like working over here. And it wasn't an arrogant thing. It was a feeling thing. But I'd always said, if America wants me, they'll find me. If they want me, they will come and get me. Because I don't see America as being the holy grail for acting and performing. There's more opportunities because they have a wider range of films and TV programs and channels and things like that. So it's just, I see where it's, the next step, but for me, it's not the all and everything. I was making a living out of my job. And I really enjoyed the work I was getting here. Mm. I figured if it happened, it would happen, but I wasn't going to go chasing for it.
Yeah.
So then I never went out to do pilot season. I never really fought for jobs over there. I always said the only way I'm going to go out there is if I'm working. And I don't know why I said that. It was just something I felt. Then after, you know, some years, a manager from the States contacted my agent and said, you know, does he have representation? They said, you know, no. You know, does he want to talk to us? So I set up a Skype meeting and met with my current manager now. And I said, look, I'll give it a year. If nothing happens, then I'm kind of good. But, you know, I'm not going to move out to the States. And I'm not going to stay there. I said, so if it's going to happen, it's going to happen from self-taping and me being over here, but I'm not interested in going living over there. And they said, okay, fine. And eventually things started to come my way. I was turning down a lot of stuff because it just didn't seem like the right sort of stuff for me.
Again, there's a pattern here. There's a theme.
I'm liking it. And my manager said to me, listen, you're not going up for anything. We have to put you out there and let people see that you're doing stuff. So can you just, like, put yourself on tape for something? I said, okay, do you know what? Up the next 10 you send me, whatever it is, I'll put myself on tape and I'll send it out there. I said, but if there are things that I don't want to do, that's on you because I'm not going to end up doing them. And after that 10, I'm going back to doing things my way. And he said, okay, fine, thank you. Just so turns out that within that 10, counterpart.
Right.
And I got the job, I went over there, and that was my first, you know, US experience. And then from there, it just kind of has kept going. But I knew that that was going to be my route because I knew the cattle market style pilot season thing wasn't going to work. And I've seen friends... While I was out there, I saw friends doing, you know, 13 auditions a week and all 11 to 15 pages long. And by day three, the quality of their work just isn't any good. So how are they going to get a job in the first place?
Well, how can anybody do that? I remember when I was in New York and I was going, I can't possibly do this. It's physically impossible for me to go into a room for all of, a few minutes and try and deliver to the best of my ability.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to do it because... I always, you know, I say to people, well, the last thing they're going to remember is you going in for that audition.
Yeah.
Oh no. We saw them do that, and you know what? They were terrible. They don't know that you've had 7 auditions that day. They don't know that something bad's happened in your life, and you're bringing that into the room, and it's conflicting with your work. They don't know. So go in there, and you know.
And it's also that thing of, you've got an audition tomorrow.
No, I haven't.
And that's exactly my answer.
They want it in by 9 o'clock. No.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. But here's the thing. What you realise is, you know, they always go, okay, you can do it next week. You go, well, why don't you say that in the fucking first
place? Exactly my point. Exactly.
But as actors, we are all sort of conditioned to be so beholden to them, whoever they are, because they have the jobs that we want. So we end up doing backflips, trying to get those jobs, and really taking back a bit of ownership and power and self, and going, my performance is not going to be very good if I deliver it to you tomorrow and I've stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to learn 15 pages worth of script. I'm actually, do you know what? It's not for me. I'm out. If that's what you want from me, it's best you get it from somebody
else. I'm not your guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm okay with that.
But I think, you know, it's like what we were saying before, you know, when we're on the floor and there's no us and them and there's no sort of beholding to the producer. It's like, we're a team. We're working together. Let's have a... If we have a difficulty, which inevitably we will, because there's always problems, so we sit down and we discuss how we can, you know, negotiate the best way to play this out, because we've all got different... We've all sat at home, done our prep and thought, oh, this is going to be what it's like, and this is the location, this is how it's going to work. Inevitably, that isn't how it's going to be, because the world doesn't fucking revolve around you, and it revolves around other people, and it's a balance.
Yeah.
And it's about listening, and it's about acceptance. But yet, more and more, I think you're right about taking back that ownership. And how many times have we screamed, why didn't you say that in the first place?
In first place,
Don't make out. Yeah, you're the one that's starting this. Don't do that. Let's work together. You want to cast it. At this stage, I kind of want to do it. Let's try and work together to see if we can make that a possibility.
But here's the worst thing I think about the industry that happens at that thing is that at some point, once the power shifts or you get to a certain level in your career that they feel they can't treat you like that anymore, you all of a sudden you start getting treated differently because some things that happened, you know, that would have happened to me 10 or 15 years ago, there's no, it just doesn't happen anymore because apparently I've gotten to a certain level or, you know, you and I have gotten to a certain level that, you know, you can now see the whole script. Why couldn't I see the whole script 15 years ago?
Only show the children what they need to know.
And it's crazy.
Do you know what I mean?
You know, how is it like, now? How is it now I get a week to prepare? I get a week now to prepare, you know, a self-tape. Before I got a couple of days. Why? Because I wasn't considered, you know, a worthy enough actor or I hadn't reached a level that was... worthy of that amount of respect.
Nicholas, honestly, I'm so, despite our mad tech issues, which the listeners won't even know because producer Griff was just going to splice this thing together. It's going to be sweet as a nut.
Fantastic.
It's been an absolute delight. I'm sorry we have time restraints, but no doubt I've got a feeling we may be speaking again.
Can we do this again?
I've got a feeling that's going to happen because I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I can't wait till the sun shines again and we can meet up in real life and wander through a lovely park.
No, well, let's do that. And I want to work with you. I'm trying to find something for all the people I want to work with and you are on my list.
Stick me on that list.
Really want to make that happen at some point.
It'd be an absolute delight. I have a feeling we'd get on very, very well.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Nicholas Pinnock, you're an absolute joy. You take care and loads of love, my friend.
Lots of love.
Take care, man.
To you, man.
Bye.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
And another episode is done. How about that? I know you'd enjoy it. What a fantastic human being. And we did kind of run out of time because we both had other things to do, but I think you can hear that we both really got on. And I'm definitely going to have Nicholas back on the podcast, definitely. We'll see how his trip to Romania was. One thing that we briefly touched on, we mentioned that Nicholas is an ambassador for Mind and certain topics that we delved into on this episode. So if you feel that you are not coping with certain things in your life at the moment, there are amazing charities such as Mind that you can talk to, and I would strongly urge you to do that and seek help because there is always somebody there to talk to. Remember that, okay? Right, so I'm off. I'm going to go on the school run. The joy of the school run. So until next week, keep getting in touch with us, downloading, subscribing. Do tell your friends. If you are feeling flush and you like the podcast and you'd like to support us, we are on patreon.com/thetwoshotpodcast. And there's loads of tiers there. £1 a month, £3 a month, whatever you want to spare. If you're enjoying all the work that myself and producer Griff have been churning out over these years, you know how much we love it, and we'll just keep doing it, shall we? Yeah? Seems like a good thing to do in these times. Keep the conversation going. So, until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson, he's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our brilliant music is courtesy of Then Thickens.